Welcome to Bare Naked Money, the podcast where we strip down the complex world of finance to its bare essentials with your hosts, Josh Shellick and Colin White, portfolio managers with Varican Capital Management, Inc.
Catherine said there's a couple of the intermediary segments that she thinks might be interesting. So I don't know. She'll maybe capture some of the chit chat in between.
I told you that our best stuff is completely unscripted.
That's for sure. That's for sure.
Hi.
The man, hey, the myth, the legend, Mr. Colin Smith.
Good day, sir.
Once again, I'm surrounded by Collins. There's too many Collins on this team. We got to come up with better nicknames for everybody.
I think we should hire more. That way we outrank all the other names.
That's right. Only Collins get to vote. We'll have a new system.
It would certainly make our job search a little bit easier. We're only searching for Collins.
You want to do the intro, Mr. Shellick?
Yeah, sure. So we have Colin Smith today checking in from New Brunswick. So after these segments, we'll have just about all the provinces, I think, covered in Canada, which is pretty awesome. So unique perspectives. And Colin, you always come with some great stories. Why don't you give our audience the 30-second overview of your background and your history?
So I come from Manulife Bank, was where I started in the financial industry about 20 years ago. And so I have a very strong lending background. Then I switched over and we opened up our own mortgage company, and I moved on to become a financial advisor after that. So that's where I come from for my background.
Amazing. And with all of that varied experience in the finance industry, I'm sure you will have some pretty awesome stories because you always do. And so why didn't you kick us off? Or Colin, go ahead. You have something to share.
Well, I was going to say, before you get started, how hard was this for you to come up with like the one absolute worst? Like, was there like a top five that you really struggled with, or is there one that really completely stood out for you?
No, actually, I think it's my actual comments are not a scenario, but it's many, many in general. So I see this all the time. And at the end of the day, it's probably the worst advice that you can get financially, in my opinion. And that's purchasing a vehicle on an eight-year term.
Well, you know, I can chime in here personally before you flesh this out a little bit more, because that was advice that my mother gave me as a teenager when I was looking at cars. She looked at me and said, "You're always going to have a car payment." And when your mother tells you that, it must be true. So yeah, but please do go on with the 8-year amortizations, because that is a really good piece of the equation.
Absolutely. I think the worst one that I saw was a gentleman who did an 8-year lease on a truck. It was an $85,000 truck, and he put a 20-year lease on his trailer, so that he bought the truck so he could pull the 20-year lease on the trailer. In both cases, neither one of those are going to make it to their amortization period. And my opinion is, if you can't afford to buy it in a 5.5-year period, then you probably can't afford to buy it.
So what makes the 8-year so bad? Like, okay, you're at the end of your amortization period, 8 years in, you have this truck or you no longer have the truck. Why is that such a problem?
It's basically because of compounding interest. I mean, at the end of the day, you're paying interest in advance, and most lenders will, when they do lend, the amortization is, the interest is charged in advance. So the first 3.5 years of your payments are generally interest only payments. And that's why people get to the end of their end of 4 years, when you really should be looking for a new vehicle or purchasing a new one, and they still have full amounts owing on their loans and can't understand why.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, early on in the mortgage, or early on in the borrowing, whatever it is, whether it's a mortgage, a vehicle payment, or something like that, a lot of your payment or more of your payment goes towards interest than paying down the principal. So I see what you're saying there. And that, you're right. A lot of people are looking to turn over cars in a fairly short time frame, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. So you're saying that in your experience, you've seen these people show up with a surprise look on their face, maybe, when they realize that a good chunk of their loan is still outstanding. And the vehicle at that point, with the vehicle especially, is probably worth less than the loan payment. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct. That's absolutely correct.
But you guys don't understand how it works. You know, you just don't get it, because it's dead easy just to go lease another vehicle, because you just roll that shortfall into the next vehicle. And in fact, I was at a conference where a institution that rhymes with Smoshestank announced that they were willing to go up to 225% of the purchase price of a new vehicle on a vehicle lease. So you could go so far completely underwater that you owed over two times the actual value of your vehicle, and they would do an auto lease for you.
So is that where you just go for death and your insurance covers it?
Well, you know, it's tomorrow. Like, we'll deal with that tomorrow.
Right.
So, you know, not only is it that one lease is a bad idea, like an 8-year amortization, you know, it's the fact that they give you the opportunity to do that multiple times to get yourself so completely underwater that you actually owe twice the value of the actual asset. And yes, that's probably going to be only gotten out of at the time of your death. So
not only the value of the interest rate side of things, it's also the value of the vehicle. I mean, at the end of the day, the average person puts on anywhere between 30 to 40,000 kilometers, and that's average. I put on a lot more than that. So if you average that over an 8-year period, your vehicle has 320,000 kilometers on it by the time you're done paying for it. How many repair jobs do you have to put in during that period of time? And that's the other reason why the 5.5-year period makes more sense, because you're done paying. If you're going to keep it, and I get that argument quite a bit, well, I drive my car into the ground anyway. Well, if you're driving it into the ground, there's definitely going to be some fixing that needs to happen around 200,000 kilometers. I can almost guarantee at 250, there's going to be some pretty large ones. And at 300,000 kilometers, I can guarantee you're going to have some problems. So at the end of the day, making your usual car payment that has been 8 years long, plus paying for repairs, it's just not feasible. It's not a good financial decision.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It digs a hole that you really can't get yourself out of. And the problem is that people who do that tend to be paycheck to paycheck. They don't have a lot extra in their day-to-day. So when those really big repairs show up and you still have a car payment, you're trying to find the $1,000 or $2,000 or $3,000 to repair the clutch, the transmission, or the major, you know, component that needs fixing. And you've strapped yourself so close, you know, because you got a much nicer car, because over 8 years you could afford that payment. It's just a compounding problem that's just going to cause never-ending stress for you.
So Collins, can we chalk this up as borrowing long-term for a depreciating asset generally a bad idea?
Absolutely.
Be aware of the hole you're digging yourself. You know, just because you can afford the payment doesn't make it a good financial decision. There's other ways to look at it.
Or make sure you have a backhoe to fill it back in.
There you go. Best advice ever. Thanks, Colin.
We're going to end this with you and I giving our best pieces, right? Like, that's how the big culmination, the big...
I don't know. Well, I've been debating, because you know what? I've really struggled to come up with one of my own. That's totally unique, you know? So I don't know.
Well, maybe Steve will inspire you. Maybe Steve's story will draw out of you the brilliance that is there, Josh.
Yeah, I'm sure it will. How you doing?
Great.
Colin said that you're going to have a full podcast's worth of stories for us.
No.
Oh, come on. With the life that you've lived and the things that you've seen.
I've got just one scenario to kind of share. It's multifaceted, but yeah.
You want to do the intro, Colin?
I don't think I'm qualified to do an intro for Steve. Steve is one of the most experienced people on our team. He's one of our portfolio managers. He is our chief operating officer, and he is a wealth of knowledge that he shares with all the team on a regular basis. So here's the Steve.
Thanks, Colin. It's a privilege to be included in Bare Naked Money. So thanks for the opportunity. I thought long and hard about that one piece of investment advice that's the worst that I've ever had. But as you've alluded to, I've been around for a long time. I've been involved in investing for over 40 years now. And finding that one piece of advice, really a bad advice, really doesn't work out very well. So I thought I would take a little bit of a different approach and look more at the sources of investment advice that are more likely to bomb than to add value to your portfolio.
Nice.
And Josh can relate to this. He might be a little bit young, because I don't know if his dressing room is the same. But for me, for the last 25 years or so, the place that offers the absolute worst investment advice is a senior men's hockey dressing room. The amount of incorrect general information about wealth management that I've heard in that dressing room over the years is mind-boggling. And over the last few years, there's more and more guys that are hitting 60 and 65 that I play hockey with. And one of the things that comes up all the time is somebody makes the comment that everybody should take their CPP at 60, you know, and others chime in and they say things like, yeah, CPP is going to run out of money, or you'll never live long enough to get the value out of waiting to 65 or 70. And I try and chime in once in a while and straighten them out and explain that it's a very personalized decision. But the power of the group think takes over. And I've seen a couple of guys make some really bad decisions. But it goes way beyond that. And where it really gets crazy is when people start recommending stocks. And it's usually something that's in the news. And I haven't come across one that's worked out yet in all the years. And we can just, you know, Josh might not remember Nortel. He's read about it in the history books, but Colin was around then. I know at least 10 guys in the past, back when Nortel went bust, that when it went below $20, they were buying it up like crazy, thinking that it was such an incredible bargain because it had been trading at 6 or 7 times that price a few months earlier. Nortel went to nothing. Another one that was even more mind-boggling was Briex. Again, that one dates way back, but Briex was a high flyer. Many of you probably remember the story. The news came out about the fraud that had taken place. The stock went and dropped off, but it was still trading for a period of time in penny stock range. And there was all sorts of people singing its praises, how it was going to come back and jumping in on it. But I think the absolute worst scenario that I've ever experienced in all those years isn't that far back, and that was the pot stock sector. And the buzz on pot stocks in the hockey dressing room was like nothing I had ever heard before, and we all knew where that one ended up. And this extends beyond the hockey dressing room. You know, my cautionary note to anybody that's listening is cocktail parties, dinner parties, anywhere where you've got a, where you have a group scenario and the excitement is building and there's not a lot of rational investment thesis behind that excitement, that's probably one to sit back and listen and not pay too much attention to, and certainly not take any action on it. There has been one positive suggestion that came out of a hockey dressing room. But I have to admit, I was the perpetrator of turning the mind shift of the dressing room on that one. And this goes back to when COVID hit, and it was just before the lockdown. So we still had a couple of hockey games. The markets had dropped off by 30%, but everything hadn't been locked down yet. And the dressing room was all abuzz, and a few guys started saying, you should sell out your portfolio. Things are going to get so much worse. We were already down 30%. I couldn't let that one go by. I chimed in. I started citing some historical information. And then a couple of other guys that were on the team kind of jumped on the bandwagon with me. And thankfully, I do not believe that anybody on our team that year bailed out of the markets. And I did have a couple of guys actually thank me 9 months later when they were up in their portfolios versus sitting there wondering when they're going to get back into the market.
For the forces of good. We used to refer to it as the taxi driver test. If the conversation you had could be plausibly had with your taxi driver, it's probably not good financial advice. And, you know, because back in the day, you know, any cab driver or Uber driver you got into a vehicle with would pitch you their, you know, how they were going to get rich off of pot stocks or Nortel or Briex. That's where those conversations were happening.
Well, that's hilarious that you mentioned that, because I happened to take a shuttle from the car dealership when I was getting my back to the office when I was getting some repairs done on my car. And the shuttle driver asked me what I did. I told him, and he said, oh, I want to tell you about what I've done. He liquidated his RSP, rolled it all into a TFSA, and has invested 100% in Tesla. It gets worse.
And when was this, Steve? How many months ago?
I'm not sure. I didn't ask him what his timing was on it, but it didn't sound like it was a recent decision. But what gets worse is he had locked in a mortgage and he was expecting the Tesla to go through the roof so that when his mortgage came due, he was going to be able to pay it off. This gentleman is 80 years old. And for the life of me in that 20-minute ride, I could not talk him out of that position. But yep, the cab driver story is a good one. It ties in.
Yeah, no, it's something that can stick in your head. If this is a conversation I could plausibly be having with my Uber driver, my cab driver, or my shuttle driver, probably, it's not a sound financial decision.
That's a good rule, Colin. We'll mark that down as one of the other number one rules of investing.
And I think I know the answer to this one, Steve, but has the chatter around the dressing room got better or worse over the years? And what I mean by that is, have people made incrementally better or worse decisions, or has it stayed exactly the same?
Worse, because I think one of the things that happen is as guys start to retire, they start dabbling in other things that they may not have had time to while they were working. So more crazy ideas have a tendency to come out. They don't get more intelligent about investing. They spend more time reading chat boards and stuff like that to come up with ideas that they think are the next big thing.
And the tragedy in this is as you go into retirement, you should and you will find things to fill your time. Now, if you can find nice, non-dangerous things to play with other than your financial future, that's better. Like, you know, yes, spend time reading stuff, but don't put your financial future at risk based on you're just nattering around with something.
Good point.
Well, that's awesome, Steve. I think you have a lot of examples over the years, and to come up with that one, I think is a good one. So we appreciate the time.
My pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity, guys.
All right.
Steve's good at that. We should have him on more podcasts.
We should, yeah. He seemed to be actually thankful that we would have him on, but it's a privilege to have him.
He felt he should say that, I think.
Yeah. All right.
Hello.
Amanda, welcome.
Hi. How are you guys doing?
Excellent. How are you?
Pretty good.
Good. So we went from one of the oldest members of our team to one of the newer members of our team, more of a younger and fresher perspective. But Amanda, portfolio manager, working out of our Nova Scotia offices, we're super excited to have you and share all of your insights for the worst financial advice that you've ever heard.
I was just going to say that Steve must have had a really good story because he took my time slot and his time slot to tell it.
Well, it tends to be that Colin and I usually chit chat back and forth a little bit with Steve or whoever as well. So these things have consistently gone a little bit over the 5 minute time slot allotted to each individual. So okay. We have all the time in the world, Amanda.
Okay. No pressure. So I was thinking about my story. And so before I got into the wealth industry, I worked in the car industry for about 7 years as a financial services manager there. So I have my fair share of interesting stories from that world. But one of them that really stuck out for me was one time I had a young man in my office applying for a car loan. And we're going through the application process, and he lets me know that he has just filed for bankruptcy at the age, I believe he was maybe 20 years old. He explained that it was from just credit card debt. So it made me think, you know, how much credit card debt could you accumulate at that point that you feel or you were advised that you needed to file bankruptcy at that point? And then it was a conversation of saying, you are not approved for this car loan because of you just filed bankruptcy, and the shock on his face when he realized that when you file for bankruptcy, it's not, oh, you have a clean slate now, and, you know, you can just forget that ever happened and carry on with your life. So that was mind-blowing to me. I was quite shocked that happened and that somebody advised him to do that when there probably were other options that he could have taken at that time.
Yeah, that is one of the uglier sides, you know, because you take a look at the amount of advertising you see from insolvency trustees and the number of accounting firms that have purchased insolvency practices. It's actually high margin work, you know, but if you go to see somebody for credit counseling, well, they're going to get paid if they put together a proposal. So it's one of those conflicts that's inherent in the system that's not as well understood. So yes, I've run across quite a few people in their early 20s that have been advised accordingly when they really didn't need to. Like, you actually took a look at their finances and it wasn't necessary. But at that age, they just don't have the perspective. Mm-hmm. And for someone to come in and say, hey, you can go bankrupt and we'll get rid of all this debt.
All your problems will go away if you just do this. Yeah.
To a 20-year-old's like, well, I'd like if my problems went away. This sounds like fun.
Yeah.
You know, but not understanding consequences. Yeah, that's also part of being a 20-year-old. So.
Yeah.
In a previous job, I would regularly get bankruptcy filings coming in. I worked for an insurance company. So when the individual was unable to pay their premiums for their insurance policy or whatever it was, we'd get the bankruptcy filing coming in. And the claims were almost always for people between, I would say, 20 and 35. And it was always unsecured consumer debt, almost always, that was the cause of the issue. You never see people that are bankrupt because of a mortgage or any business loan or anything like that. At least the ones that I was seeing, it was more so you had $20,000 of credit card debt, $15,000 of student loans, an unsecured line of credit for $10,000, and here you are with $45,000 of debt and no way to get above it. So really interesting that this experience is kind of similar on your side, Amanda. And did you ask the guy if he had got any advice who had recommended this, or did he just decide, ooh, bankruptcy sounds cool?
I'm not sure, you know, where he got the advice from or how he came across that this was the decision that he had to take in order to solve his problem. I don't remember, but I think it was from, I remember speaking to him, and I think this happens with a lot of young people, is just not being educated and understanding the consequences of this, and that, you know, for bankruptcy, it's going to carry with you for the next 7 years or even longer. So I think it was just him looking for an out and just being uneducated about how to do it.
Well, we have to understand how important that is to the system, because if we didn't have people overspending their means, then the economy wouldn't grow. So we need a certain number of people to behave like this for the overall society to work as we currently have it set up. Mm-hmm. So there's a vested interest in keeping the status quo moving. And also having a dreaming teenager who, you know, really wants to be something or make something of themselves. Yeah, that's going to lead them down this path for sure.
Well, that's sad. Great, man. It's a second, it's a sad, yes, but second car related one that we've true. Had. Yeah,
interesting.
So maybe a trend. Careful, okay. Everybody's car out there.
Yeah, I'm interested to hear the other stories.
Yeah. Thanks for your time.
Awesome. See you guys.
Thanks. Yeah.
All right. Devin's up next.
Hey, Dev. Guys. How's it going?
Great. How are you?
Am I being recorded?
No,
just this is not one of those calls. You'll be recorded for quality control purposes. Yeah. But yes, you're being recorded.
Okay, sounds
for
good.
The record.
You know, try not to say anything stupid then.
No worries about that. I'm sure. But by way of introduction, we have Devin Catalan here. He's a portfolio manager and partner with the firm, and been in the wealth advisory business basically since you graduated. Isn't that right, Dev?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, just around 10 years now.
Awesome. So you've seen a lot of bad financial advice, I'm sure, in your 10 years. What do you have to share as the worst piece of advice you've heard about?
So probably the piece that's most relevant at the moment, because we just purchased a property. So we're moving from a house, from a condo into a home. And so the piece that's most relevant to me is when people say, real estate's the best investment. And so real estate is a good investment. It can be a good investment. But it's not the best investment out there. We went back and I looked at some numbers in terms of how it's actually performed over the 6 years that I owned it. And a lot of people forget about some of the major costs that you incur when purchasing a real estate property or when making a move. So some quick ones that came up that are significant expenses are real estate brokerage commissions, right? I mean, those are anywhere from 4 to 6%, depending on what you negotiate with the broker. So that's a significant chunk of your profits from a property being sold that aren't accounted for. There's land transfer tax, which in Toronto is between 1 and 2%, which is pretty significant. So that adds up as well.
Don't they have a double land transfer tax in Toronto as well, Dev?
Yeah. Yeah. So we get the pleasure of paying higher prices for our real estate, but then also getting slapped with higher taxes as well. So it's just to make sure you have no money left over and all your money's in the home.
Well, so, it's all for the proper urban planning that keeps traffic flowing so well around Toronto. I mean, it costs a lot of money to get things to that level.
It does. Yeah. And all the repairing we do on our expressways that, never actually get done, but that's a separate discussion.
Sorry, we distracted from your point. Carry on, all the expenses you're going through.
Even things like moving costs and legal costs for closing. So the list goes on as you actually go through it and you break it down. And then that's not to take into account all the ongoing costs too, like maintenance and interest payments on your mortgage, and to be fair, some of those expenses you would be covering either, you know, they offset the cost of rent, for instance, that you would mm-hmm. you'd be having to pay for some kind of living expenses, but so just going through the numbers, it was a little disappointing to see what the return was over the past 6 years. It worked out to less than a 2% return, closer to the 1% mark.
I did way better than you did over 17 years. I was just under the Canadian bond index for the period of time when I held my home. So,
yeah, we actually did. We did do a forensic accounting of Colin's property purchase and sale as well. That was last year, I think it was, right, Colin?
Yeah, 2 years ago now. But yeah,
two years ago. Yeah. So, you know what's funny, Dev? It doesn't surprise me at all that you did this exercise.
Just to save everybody from looking it up, you know, Devin is one of them, their CFAs and spreadsheets everything, and is the most amazing math guy. He's got a degree in math. So this is what we expect from Devin when he goes through any experience. And it's fabulous because somebody needs to be doing the math, and we appreciate him for having done the math on this and sharing, because it's very, very valuable perspective. You know, there's this whole trying to debunk the idea that all you need to do is be real estate and your world is fine. You know, we're not calling it necessarily a bad asset class, but it's not the answer to everybody's problems.
Absolutely. Yeah, I had some fun with the exercise. Recommend people going through it when they buy and sell.
We're going to do a whole separate podcast where you actually walk everybody through the spreadsheet that you developed and how to use it. Yes.
Excellent. That's my dream.
Yeah. Stay tuned for that, Dev. We'll call you back shortly.
Sounds good.
Thanks, buddy.
Yeah. All right. Thanks. Take care, guys. Bye bye.
Maria up next. She could go a lot of different directions.
She could. And it's going to be from a very different perspective.
Hello.
Hi, Maria. How are you?
I'm well. How are you guys?
Very good. We're just saying that we're excited for yours because we don't really know which direction you're going to go. I think you come from a bit of a different background than a lot of the other members of our team. Like we haven't really had a true, somebody that comes from an analyst background, that's talked yet. So that is your background. You've been both a credit analyst and an equity analyst in the past, and you're now a research analyst on our team. So I'm really curious to see what the worst financial advice that you have ever heard is.
So I think actually, it hasn't happened to me directly, but what I've heard from a friend of mine who works in the industry, a portfolio manager that he or she used to work for, back in, I think, 2017, when blockchain was the buzz and all of these companies were doing IPOs off of and having no revenue, was in a part of that craze and got brought into that. He was a discretionary portfolio manager. So took on one of these companies, did a few private placements for it. And essentially, so this company, again, had no revenue, no fundamentals, put it in a few of clients' accounts. It was fine for a bit. It kind of hung in there. And then after people didn't care about blockchain anymore, it went to zero and is now delisted. So a lot of the clients fared fine. They were pretty mad about it, but it was 1 or 2% of their portfolio. But apparently one of the clients was who was, I think, 80 or 83, had 100% of his RRSP in the stock. And he lost everything. Yeah.
Yeah, that's tragic and a whole bunch of levels, and more disappointing because it comes with professional advice got them there.
And like whatever the PM did or didn't say was wrong, you know, like he, if he didn't say anything, he should have and explained to the guy that this is a terrible idea. Or if he was talking to the client and egging him on saying that he's going to 10x his money, then that's a massive red flag. So I hope that he had another account somewhere. That's all I'm saying.
Well, yeah, there's a couple of things to take from your story. And, you know, an IPO that Maria's referencing is an initial public offering. So it's a company going to market for the first time for the benefit of our listeners. And a couple of things you said, like with no revenue, like for company, you know, investing in something that has no revenue, that's not a sentence. You can speculate on something that has no revenue, but you can't invest in something that has no revenue. You know, so, and to watch that go into somebody's portfolio. And it also brings to light the different types of advice, because some advisors have a suitability standard where, you know, is this a suitable investment? And it could be that 80-year-old had like $5 million and 5% of his portfolio could be high risk. But to have a fiduciary standard, which is the portfolio management standard, that standard would preclude making an investment such as that. In fact, we would not allow something like that to happen. But and for the record, because there's a video component to this, as the person who's in charge of paying for heat in the office, Maria has the ability to turn the heat as high as she wants, and she chooses to wear her coat in the office. I just want to make sure that goes on the record. I appreciate that about you, but people could look in from the outside and think we're being abusive. So
I'm not being abusive, no.
Okay.
Yet. I'm kidding.
Well, one of the sad parts of this as well is you mentioned the fiduciary standard, Colin, but as Maria said, this was somebody that was a discretionary portfolio manager. Mm-hmm. So they have a higher standard of care for their clients. They have a higher level of responsibility. They, in theory, have a higher degree of education and experience and should know best to avoid some of these things. But even the most experienced and professional and let's call it educated or credentialed individuals in our industry sometimes aren't still providing suitable advice for people.
Yeah, absolutely. And when I heard this, I was just so puzzled, because I was like, there had to be so many systems that failed and overlooked this, because there's systems in place that if anything's 100% of your portfolio, that should be a flag to your compliance officer. And if you see that person is 80 years old,
that should be
that IPS.
I love your faith in the system, Maria. I really do.
Well, that made me think otherwise. But hopefully the guy's doing good and the PM paid for it.
Well, but I think it's important, because again, whenever people are listening to stories like this, how do I protect myself? If anybody brings you an investment and they say there's zero revenue, it's just say no. Like, no matter what comes after that, just say no, and your world will be a better place.
Yeah. And I also think that some advisors know that these deals, maybe there was some sort of commission structure for this that he benefited from. And then
I was gonna
took advantage.
Ask, I'd say more than maybe. I'd say almost
for
100%.
Sure.
Yeah.
Right. And then they kind of look for the people or their clients who maybe aren't as knowledgeable in investments, and they don't really have to pitch investment ideas because they don't know the questions to ask, which is fair, but that's why I'm paying you as a portfolio manager. So self-fulfilling prophecies are definitely still out there, and screw the client over, which sucks.
So yeah, I love that you still have expectations of the world. But you know, this is more common than you want to believe, but thank you for bringing it forward and shining a light on it, because you know, you don't want to get blasé about these things. You don't want to say, well, that happens all the time, because that's wrong too. And to highlight it now, thank you very much for bringing it forward.
Thank you.
Thanks, Maria.
All right. See you guys.
All right. Last one.
Oh, the great Matt is here. He is a portfolio manager with us here in the heart of downtown Halifax, head office, as it were. Been with us for quite a few months now, and brings with him quite a background in the industry. On a few different sides of the industry. So I can't wait to hear how he's going to come about with the worst piece of financial advice he's experienced or seen in his life. Matt, we saved the best for last, buddy, so don't let us down. You're the big finish.
All right. Well, this is a, I think this is a very good one. I hope you enjoyed it. It doesn't actually come from advice that was given to me, or certainly not given by me. It was given to a friend of mine, and unfortunately, he took it for a period. This is a friend of mine who studied accounting in university and started out at one of the big firms on, you know, in sort of the CPA class, to hoping to be on the partner track. And as part of that sort of class, I don't know, Frosh Week, I mean, Colin, you might know how they do this better than I do. One of the senior partners came in to speak to the group about what it means to be an accountant, what it means to be on this path. And part of his advice to this group was, you're all going to be partner. You should begin to spend today for the earnings you're going to have. Live the lifestyle today that you'll eventually grow into. And now keep in mind, this is a group of students who were earning $29,000 a year, probably at the time. And I don't have the exact stats, but I think we all know that not everyone in that class makes partner. It's not a bad thing. It's just the nature of how it works. So needless to say, well, he took that advice from the senior partner. Of course, I should listen to this person. I want to be a partner. And well, he paid the price for doing so. He had a lot of fun for a period, but it $29,000 only goes so far.
It's escaping me, Josh. Who was the other person that brought forward this?
I don't know. I honestly can't remember either. I'd have to go through the list, but there is somebody else, Matt, who brought forward a very similar conversation from somebody, similar recommendation that you should. The other one was you should basically always spend above your means. And I don't know where this idea comes from, but this is very much along the same lines. I guess in this case, it's a little bit better because it's not always above your means. If you do make partner, maybe you're back within your means, but yeah, seems insane.
Well, it's also self-gratifying. If you're telling somebody, it's like, listen, you know, don't worry about it. Just go take that $20,000 line of credit and blow it on your lifestyle because that's what you should do. Oh, okay, fantastic. I get to spend 20 large on myself. Well, I'm going to take a trip. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that, the other thing. And you feel that it's the right thing to do. So you're being given permission to be selfish almost. So there's, you know, some people sitting in the room, you know, just looking for an excuse to overextend themselves. And like, well, the senior partner told me I should do this. Well, obviously it's the right thing to do. And you're stupid if you're not doing the same thing I'm doing. You're not doing the math, and less than 1% of that room's ever going to be partner. And it's going to happen 20 years from now. And, you know, you're going to have to go bankrupt before you get there.
It was Colin Shipp that brought the other one forward, right?
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thanks for that, Matt. We appreciate you reinforcing some bad advice and a different, and actually, honestly, a more harmful environment, because that was coming from an actual position of power. I mean, that was somebody in a position of power who has say over the future of the people in the room, telling them to do that. So yeah, that's actually, you know, I'm going to score that as way worse than the Colin Shipp story happening at a barbecue, because you can pretty easily dismiss that one. It's harder that's to right. dismiss it when it's the partner of the firm that's giving the advice. So
yeah. So how's your friend doing now, Matt?
He's figured out his ways and he's gotten back on track. Now this partner he's only gotten more lavish. So I'm sure he's still touting this advice, but, luckily, it didn't do too much harm, at least in this case.
It's amazing. That guy, the partner, based on how you're describing him, he's probably one of those people that is living above his means as well, still, even though he has made partner.
Yeah.
Misery loves company.
Yeah. Lifestyle creep's a real thing, right? Like, it absolutely is. So I think he'd be a good example of that.
All right. Wonderful. Well, thanks for finishing it off on the right foot, Matt.
Thank you both.
All right, Josh, as the host of this whole extravaganza, do you have one final thought or piece of advice that you'd want to share to add even another layer of bad financial advice?
So I've been reflecting on all of the different pieces that people have brought forward and trying to identify what do I think is truly the worst aspect of this. Maybe not one specific piece of advice, but the worst part of the theme. And one thing that I can point to that I think is almost always going to lead to just terrible financial advice is when there's a mismatch in priorities or misunderstanding of what the individual's priorities are. And you can see this very clearly from something like what Dan brought forward, where the priority is education, but a life insurance policy is put on the table. There's a mismatch between the actual priority and the advice. Yep. You can see this from what Ainsley brought to the table, somebody who's terminal and just wants to maintain what they have. And next thing you know, they're in a segregated fund that has a lot of volatility with it. Just time and time again, when there is a misunderstanding or a neglect, which I think is probably just as common, of the individual's priorities, that's going to necessarily lead to terrible financial advice.
Well, yeah, and in many decisions or many of the situations you're describing, there's a conflict somewhere in the system. Like the person giving the advice is conflicted because, you know, and it doesn't have to necessarily be malicious, but, you know, their priorities are overriding the priorities of the client, or not, you know, they're not properly taking that into account. But, you know, absolutely. Those are themes for sure. The thing that I've watched be the most damaging over time to many people's financial situation is the disproportionate faith they put in real estate. And that affects many different decisions at many different times in life and can cause many different kinds of problems, whether it's the overextending to buy a bigger home and, you know, making yourself house poor, or hanging onto a property long after it's served its useful life. You know, decisions around paying down mortgages, you know, a rush to pay down a mortgage that you're only paying 1.8% on. You know, the number of different ways I have seen home ownership and or real estate ownership be detrimental to somebody's financial outcome, for me, is the biggest theme. And Devin touched on it quite nicely, and we've talked about it in previous, and there's going to be future talk about this because we were talking the other day about pension funds and some of the stuff that's gone on there. But from a personal financial perspective, the number of bad decisions that are made around the ownership of real estate and the different ways that can come back and haunt you, for me, is the most ubiquitous thing, and has caused. But it's maybe a little difficult to say that because it's not often a tragedy.
Yeah.
But it really does lead to a much worse outcome than needed be.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's where you can kind of distinguish between some of these stories. Some of them are downright money losing, like you just see money evaporating. Yep. And others are persistently what I would call suboptimal.
Yep.
And maybe not, you know, if you bought a property 10 years ago, you're probably doing okay. Yep. Was it the best, absolute best way for you to grow your wealth? Maybe, maybe not.
Yep.
But I think that's, so there's, you're absolutely right. There's this sort of persistence where a misunderstanding of what real estate can do for you can lead to maybe suboptimal outcomes, but very rarely destructive, I would say.
Yeah, no, it can be destructive. You're right, but not on the same magnitude. But I think we're kind of drawing a line in the sand between, you know, either borderline or actual fraudulent activity. That is malicious and predatory, to, you know, somebody making a decision where they're just misaligning, they're not understanding necessarily, or acting in their own best interest.
Yeah. The one, as I going through my own history and trying to think of what came to mind most for me, was, again, kind of along the same lines as you, but life insurance that is used more as an investment product than for actual life insurance purposes. And I have seen, I think, more dollars. It's not like widely spread, this type of approach, but I've seen more dollars evaporate because of this type of approach than just about anything else. Because typically when these ideas are put forward, they're for very large dollar amounts.
Yep.
People that can probably afford it, quite frankly, but have a lot of money to go up in flames. And it's almost always coming back to a mismatch between what somebody's priorities are and what the person providing the advice or the sales approach is. And I've just seen these time and time again come back to be built on faulty premises and false promises and tens or hundreds of thousands and potentially even millions of dollars just you know, evaporating again for things that were poorly designed and poorly thought out of, and maybe not hitting the nail on the head in terms of priorities.
Well, I think it's important for us to try to put a bow on this, Josh, and it's a difficult bow to put, because on one hand, we're saying, don't listen to your friends because they're idiots. You know, whatever you do, don't go to the locker room after your hockey game and expect you're going to get advice. And then we have all these examples of people who went to professionals and got bad advice and still lost money. Yeah. So, you know, if you listen to all this, it's like, don't give up hope. Please don't give up hope. You know, there are good people out there giving good advice. We like to think we're some of them. In fact, I will tell you, we are some of them. And there are some, and we've shared as we've gone along, some basic rules that you can put in place for yourself to protect yourself from some of these things. Don't stop trying to find the right advice. There are good mortgage brokers out there. There are good accountants out there. There are good lawyers out there, a lot of them. Just because some of them aren't great doesn't mean you should stop looking. You know, you too will find love one day, and, you know, don't give up the search. It's worthwhile. And if anything that we've talked about here triggers anything for you, if you got questions for us, by all means, reach out. We'd love to engage in a conversation to be further educated in things we didn't think of as being terrible financial advice, or maybe to help steer somebody out of a bad financial decisions. If you've got that spidey sensor tingling right now going, maybe this is going to make the next podcast. And, you know, before you do it, give us a call and maybe we can talk you out of it.
Yeah, that's a great wrap up. And yeah, just to emphasize, we have a dozen or so conversations here with people that have decades and decades and decades of time in the industry. There's a lot more really good financial advice that goes on than bad financial advice. But we do want you to be aware of some of the pitfalls that are out there as well.
If you're breaking a sweat trying to figure out what your financial advisor is talking about, you're not getting the service you need. You probably hate trying to get an answer from them, but you also think moving your accounts will be a headache. And it might be. But working with DontRockTheBoatWealthPlanning.com or .ru isn't exactly stress-free, is it? Call us. We will demystify the world for you.
Please note, the information provided in this podcast is for general information purposes only. It is not intended as financial, investment, legal, tax, accounting, or other professional advice. Our discussions are not a solicitation to buy or sell any securities or to make any specific investments. Any decisions based on information contained in this podcast are the sole responsibility of the listener. We strongly advise consulting with a professional financial advisor before making any financial decisions. Listeners should be aware that investing involves risks and that past performance is not indicative of future results. Bare Naked Money is produced by Varican Capital Management, Inc., a licensed portfolio management company in Canada. We operate under the regulatory framework established by the Provincial Securities Commissions in the provinces within which we operate. The views expressed in the podcast are our own and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of any regulatory authority. Remember, at Varican Capital Management, Inc., we focus on aligning our goals with yours, prioritizing integrity and transparency. For more information about us and our services, please visit our website. Thank you for listening, and let's continue to challenge the norms of the financial services industry together.